Good evening and welcome to IMCW's Wednesday night class. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Dori Langevin. I'm part of the IMCW Teachers Council for a bit more time. As some of you know, my husband and I are leaving to move to Spokane Valley, waiting on the house to sell. But that's our plan, that he's retiring and we're going to quieter pastures where we can see the stars and where there's lots of light. And the last several weeks at class, there's been a lot of teachings around the compassion wing of the Buddhist practice, around the Bodhisattva path and that Lama Shiradas taught 2 weeks ago, and then Tara had done a two-week series on love. So one of her recommendations was that we move more towards the wisdom wing to do some wisdom teaching. And when I shared that with a beloved friend of mine in IMCW, he said, I think you ought to just teach about what you're passionate about what really is alive for you. And I said, you know, that's true. So the title of tonight's talk and the theme for actually this whole evening is called Leaving the Familiar, because that's what I'm most alive and impassioned and challenged with right now, is leaving the familiar, which is this area and this sangha. But I'll also be weaving in through the night the power of mindfulness to actually create ease where there could be potential dukkha, lots of dukkha, especially for me around the ideas of how this transition is supposed to happen. Because it doesn't. You know, my time and the universe's time are really not always in sync. And we're also going to be experimenting with and exploring anicca, or the impermanent nature of reality. And because this is called Leaving the Familiar, we're not going to do the class the way we usually do the class, which you might have gathered by now, because usually we'd be quiet and you'd be hearing a voice bringing you into your body and noticing what's happening. We're not going to do it that way. So I'm going to invite you to really enter into what's called Zen mind, beginner mind, don't know mind. That you don't know what's going to happen. I don't really know what's going to happen. I mean, I have this stuff written down and I have this kind of a plan. But really, I'm opening this up for who knows what's going to happen. I think I know what I'm going to say and I think I know what I'm going to offer you, but it's uncertain, as Ajahn Chah, the great Thai forest master, would say. It's uncertain. We don't know. But what we're really going to do is start with some interaction, some mindful interaction. Because one of the things that's been the most dear to me in living here the last 10 years has been Sangha, has been this community of people. And so I thought, rather than immediately going inside and sort of pretending that nobody else is here except for the noisy ones next to you, or the ones who come in late, or, you know, or the one you're kind of attracted to, or whatever. But, you know, That instead of going inward, we're going to connect with each other. We're going to do an embodied, open-eye meditation of mindfulness. Because mindfulness is not just our practice on the cushion. What really matters is how we take what we learn and bring it out into the world of relationship. So we're going to let the Dharma come alive through our aliveness here. So just as a way of beginning, though, just to sort of we're going to be practicing mindfulness all the time, weaving it in and out of what we're doing together. But it's really just, even right now, to take a moment and just sort of notice what's arising in you with the information and the invitation to leave the familiar and do it differently. To just check in, to pause, to just sort of see what's happening inside your own skin right now. It's like kind of taking your pulse, so to speak. To just look and feel and sense with the qualities of curiosity, interest, and of openness and friendliness. Like, how is it right now in this room, not knowing what's going to happen next? this amazing capacity to just be with things as they are, to see them as they are. This mindfulness. So we're going to be together, and then we'll do a short sitting internally, and then I'll continue with some sharing about leaving the familiar. And one of my best teachers, not in the Buddhist tradition, but in the tradition of psychodrama, said that there's no such thing as resistance. There's only an adequate warm-up. So I want to give you a little warm-up. I don't want you to have to be going in completely blind. What we're going to do is some reflection on what brings you here. We're going to do some reflection on... let me back up. We're going to do this in three stages, this interactive part. And the first is simply going to be a raise of hands. And one of the questions and one of the comments that most frequently comes up about this class is, it's so big, I don't feel like I get to know anybody. It's so big, I feel like I don't belong. It's so big, I don't know how to connect. I don't know anybody. So I'm just curious that if you identify yourself as somebody who really doesn't know anybody else here, meaning except for maybe saying hi or bye or nodding, but you really haven't had a conversation, how many of you would say that you really don't know anybody else in this room, to raise your hands? And also just still look around just to see how many of us don't really know anybody. Okay, thank you. So we're going to get to know a little bit about who we are here. That was the first part, not too hard. The second part, what I'd like you to do, each of us to do, is just to recall when you came to class for the first time. Just sort of, you know, how many years ago it was, how many months ago it was, how many weeks ago it was, or maybe tonight is your first night here at class. But just in a general way, how long that you've been coming, to pick a year, a month in your mind. And now it's not just about raising hands. What I'm going to actually ask you to do is to, you'll be identifying yourself as either in 10 years or more, somewhere around 6 to 9 years, somewhere around 2 to 5 years, somewhere around about a year, under a year, or this is your first night. So it's general. I mean, I realize those categories don't necessarily include everything, because you could be here like a year and a half, and is that about a year? Yeah, that's about a year. So I'm going to ask you to do that. If you've been here, coming to class, for 10 years or more, I'm going to ask you to stand up. Everybody's going to stand up at one point, so just to stand up. And I want you to look around at each other, because you probably know each other. But just to see, there's just a handful of people who have been around that long. But those of you who are new, these are people who you could easily go to and ask questions about class or ask questions about practice. So thank you. Now, those of you who have been coming for around, 6 to 9 years, to please stand up and to look around. Okay, so it's another handful. George is in the back, I see in the shadows. Just to see who have been here about that long. And up there, also people up there. Okay, thank you. And now the 2 to 5 year group, if you'd stand up. Now the numbers are getting bigger. So also look around and sort of see who are those that are standing. Again, if you're new, these are people, maybe you don't want to ask the people who have been here 10 years. You may want to ask people who have been here, maybe 2 to 5 years. There's a bigger number. So looking around. Okay, thank you. And now folks that have been here about a year. Not under a year, but about a year, year and a half, year and three quarters. Okay? Great. So again, everybody, so checking out. This is the group that's been here for about a year. Up there as well. Okay, thank you. Second to last group. How many have been here under a year, but it isn't your first night? Look at this. Yeah. So this is the biggest group so far. So to look around at each other and to see, do you know any of these people? Those of you who are standing up, looking at each other, standing up. You may or you may not. But notice how many more have only been here for, of you have been here for under a year. Okay, thank you. And now, those who this is their very first night, if you wouldn't mind standing for us. Okay. Big group also. And you know what? There are at least this many that are new for the first time. So please, those of you, take note and make an effort to welcome them. Make an effort to reach out. Because one of the reasons there's only a handful that have been here for a long time, in part, is I think because people have a hard time connecting to feeling like this is home for them. So welcome to you for tonight. And you're kind of, thank you, you're kind of lucky because you don't know what's familiar. You don't know what we usually do. So you have more access to Zen mind, beginner's mind, which is quite an advantage. Okay. Now it's going to get a little deeper. A little more leaving the familiar, maybe a little bit more challenging. We're going to do a little practice of mindful speaking and mindful listening, which those of you who have been here before have done this. Tara, you know, from time to time has you group or pair and share something. So you actually get to connect not just by looking at each other, but actually by speaking and listening to each other. So this is going to be really, 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 really simple. All you're going to need to do is tell the person your name, where you're from, how long you've been coming to class, and then one favorite thing, a movie, a book, a music group, a piece of music, a television show, just something that's a favorite of yours and why. Real simple, a couple of sentences. But think of something that you're willing to share. You know, you don't have We're trying to make no resistance here. So what I'm going to invite you to do is to leave the familiar and look around and find somebody, preferably who you don't know. It's easy to do this. You know, those of you especially who have been here for a while, really make the effort to see if you can connect with one other person, to stand up and just connect with one other person and find a place to sit down. To look around to somebody who you don't know or you don't know well. And all you're going to do is exchange this information. So beginning to bring your conversations to a close. Not sure I've ever heard that much noise in this room before. So now, sort of let yourself sink back into what's familiar, into your familiar place, your familiar seat. And let the attention go inward a bit. And just feel the effect of that interaction. To notice what's happening in your body, the aliveness of the sensations that are here right now. To feel whatever emotions might be moving through. There might be excitement or interest, irritation, embarrassment, joy. Just notice the condition of the inner weather system right now. There's something called the cantilever effect, which is in different kinds of sciences, but in architecture, it's the proportion of a deck that needs to be on the cliff. If you have a house that's on a cliff and you want to build a deck, that about two-thirds or so needs to be supported, needs to be on land or supported from underneath. Yes, Anya's an architect, yeah? Is it two-thirds? Yeah. So that the deck can hold the weight of whatever is going to be put there. And when I realized that, when someone told me that, it was like, that's exactly, it's a great metaphor for how to stay in your own body two-thirds, in your own awareness, so that the deck between you and other people can support the interaction. So mindfulness in life, mindfulness in interaction and in relationships is really about keeping, respecting the cantilever effect of staying in yourself enough that you can really be present with the other rather than giving yourself over completely. And sometimes that happens. We completely leave ourselves. We get a little bit mindless. So that's the practice of coming back into the body and feeling what's here to be able to do really mindful speaking and mindful listening, being in relationship in an open and receptive and really kind way. So this theme of leaving the familiar, I think we all survived so far. But one of the questions might be, well, you know, why bother to leave the familiar? You know, why choose newness? Why choose change? Or why choose stepping into the unknown? I mean, really, why take the risk of stepping out of the security of the familiar? There's everyone, I think, here knows Helen Keller, a woman who, when she was 19 months old, came down with an illness. And when she came out of 19 months old, came out of the illness, she was blind and deaf. But, of course, went on to live a very fruitful and very wonderful life. And she says this, security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men or women as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. So, why leave the familiar? One of the reasons is that we are, when we stay in the familiar, we really get caught in the illusion that change isn't happening. We just see things the same old way. We don't see the truth of what the Buddha called anicca, or impermanence. This flux, this change, this ever... I just saw a good friend. This ever-present, one good friend out of many. I'm a little nervous all of a sudden. Oh, and I can see now. Thank you. but one of the reasons is that when we're caught in the familiar, when we're caught in our habits, that we don't see this truth of impermanence. We don't see things changing. And it really is one of the characteristics of all life is that it's changing. And this insight into anicca leads to the realization that to try to hold on to what's changing, to try to control, to resist, or even to ignore change is what the Buddha called the source of suffering. So staying in the familiar has this kind of normalizing effect. And there's a teaching story which, as I checked on the internet, isn't like actually scientifically true, but it's still a good teaching story, because I'd like to check things out. But there's a lot of good teaching stories that aren't maybe necessarily true in the material world. But the story goes like this, that if you put a frog in water, in tepid water, and then in a pan, I know, he's going to die, and then you turn the fire on, that be cut very, very low, that the change in the water temperature is so gradual that he doesn't jump out because he doesn't feel the change, or she doesn't feel the change, and so the frog gets cooked. So just hold that as an... Again, this isn't real. Nobody's putting a frog in water. It's just a metaphor, okay? For all the bodhisattvas in the house. But there is this slow, insidious way in which we become accustomed to things because we're not paying attention to the way that they're actually causing harm. And when we stay in the familiar, we get hijacked by these familiar patterns and stories, just the habitual ways that we react to ourselves and we react to others, the way we see ourselves, the way we judge ourselves and hold ourselves and judge and hold others. It's a kind of entrancement that we get entranced, asleep, and not even aware that we're not making very conscious choices. We just sort of get swept away by the currents of the habits of thinking and behaviors that really are causing harm. And we know that these habits are extremely strong. They feel like they're kind of woven into the fabric of our being. And there's a joke that our habits die about 2 hours after we do, that they have a very strong hold. So leaving the familiar is about breaking habit patterns. Now, I know that there's some people in this room who have gone through the gauntlet of stopping an addictive or a harmful habit. And you know that it just didn't show up one day, that it grew over time. You know, and one day, suddenly, we said, like, how did I get here? How did my life get so awful? How did this happen? It's like that slow, insidious heating up of the water that we don't know to stop or to get out of the pan. There's the familiar habit of thinking badly about ourselves or others, the habit of judging, which we all have in one way or the other. I mean, have you really noticed how fast judgments can arise? It's like, boom, they're there. That maybe in some way we're just not enough, that we can't do this meditation thing, that we're too sleepy, that we're too restless, that we're too old, that we're too young. And there's all kinds of judgments that can come up, even in a 15-minute period of just trying to notice in a very simple way what's happening inside. Or we can judge others. You know, they're driving too fast, they're driving too slow, they're too noisy, they're arrogant. You know, we have these ways of branding ourselves and others that are incredibly unkind. The Buddha called, or Buddhist psychology calls this conditioning, like the frog in the water. And the stories that we end up telling ourselves from this conditioning are often very narrow and very unkind, and it's as if we draw a circle so tight that we feel separate from others. Many of you who have been here for a while, and we know who you are because you've stayed up, have heard many times about the Buddhist teachings of how we get conditioned to see the world through the lens that something's missing. You know, that there's not enough of what we want or what we like. And that's wanting mind, wanting more and more and more. And then there's the lens of that there's something wrong. That there's too much of what we don't like or too much of what we don't want. And that we actually have been trained to kind of scan for the unsatisfactoriness in ourselves and in others. Getting caught up in this trance of something's missing and something's wrong. It's a very familiar habit of mind. One way we get caught in the familiar is also to get hijacked by busyness. I don't know if any of you know that one. There's an editorial out of a Chicago paper that goes like this, called Sweet Nothing. How you been? Busy. How's work? Busy. How was your week? Good. Busy. You name the question, busy is the answer. Yes, yes, I know. We are all terribly busy doing terrible and terribly important things. But I think more often than not, busy is simply the most acceptable knee-jerk response. Certainly, there are more interesting, more original, and more accurate ways to answer the question, how are you? And notice how many of these are like wanting mine or not wanting mine. I'm hungry for a burrito. I'm envious of my best friend. I'm frustrated by everything that's broken in my house. That's ringing some bells. I'm itchy. Yet busy stands alone as the easiest way to summarize all that you do and all that you are. I am busy is the short way of saying, implying, my time is filled, my phone does not stop ringing, and you, therefore, should think well of me. Have people always been this busy? Did cavemen think they were busy too? This week is crazy. I've got about 10 caves to draw on. Can I meet you by the fire next week? I have a hunch that there is a direct correlation between the advent of coffee bars and the increase in busyness. Look at us. We're all pros now at hailing cabs, making Xeroxes, carpooling, performing surgery with a to-go cup in hand. We're skittering around like hyperactive gerbils. High not just on caffeine, but on caffeine's luscious byproduct, productivity. Ah, the joy of doing, accomplishing, crossing off. As kids, our stock answer to most every question, like, what did you do at school, what's new, was nothing. In our country's history, there's been exactly 7 kids who responded with a statement other than nothing. I don't think that's scientific either, but... Then, somewhere on the way to adulthood, think the frog here, is on the way to adulthood, we each took a 180-degree turn. We cashed in our nothing for busy. I'm starting to think that, like youth, the word nothing is wasted on the young. Maybe we should try reintroducing it into our grown-up vernacular. Nothing. I say it a few times, and I can feel myself becoming more quiet, decaffeinated, zen-ish. This is how mainstream Buddhism is these days. Now I'm picturing nothing. Now I'm picturing emptiness, a white blanket, a couple ducks gliding on a still pond. Nothing, nothing, nothing. How did we get so far away from it? So do you remember, if your life is busy, the time before busyness, like BB, before busyness? And how often we have to schedule in time to slow down, to do nothing, to stop accomplishing and striving and trying to control our environment to get what we want. You know, we're working so hard, and the news just this week or last week, there was a report on how many millions of Americans are working at least 60 hours a week and how the impact, what the impact is on their health, their kids, and their relationships. So I don't know about the kids today. Maybe they're not saying nothing. This is a cartoon from Those Lazy Days of Summer, and it's just one cell, and there's a little girl standing on her front doorstep, and she has something that looks like a book in front of her, and there's a friend of hers standing in front of her on the walkway to the house, and she says, "Let's see, I've got leadership class, leadership camp, summer school, swimming lessons, soccer skills clinic, but I can probably pencil in just being a kid into my calendar sometime next Friday." So they're learning at their parents' knee about busyness. It's really radical to slow down, to pause, to feel space around you and within you, to feel silence and the sweet nothing-to-do-ness. It's radical. It's what the Buddha called swimming upstream. In fact, after his full enlightenment, when he'd had his awakening and he saw suffering and the source of suffering and the cessation of suffering and the path to the cessation of suffering, which was what he set out to do, he looked around the world and he said, "I don't think they're going to want to hear this. They're too materialistic. They're too caught up in themselves." And he was not motivated to teach. He didn't think anybody'd really be interested. Now, the myth goes that the Brahmin gods had him look again with the eyes of compassion at the world and see how much time people were spending really wanting to be happy but doing just the opposite of what actually brought them happiness. And his great heart of compassion opened and he realized that it was sort of the right thing to do would be to teach the Dharma as he had realized it. But he said it's radical, it's swimming upstream. So we can get hijacked by judging, we can get hijacked into the familiar patterns of wanting and not wanting, of busyness. And this hijacked by the wanting mind, this something's missing that is activated by getting pleasant stimulation through the senses, seeing, tasting, touching, hearing, feeling, smelling. And we want more. It's just the natural way that we're wired to grasp after what's pleasant and to want more of it. Because we think that if we get more, we'll be happy. But really what happens is when we get more, we just want more. And the classic teaching around that, and Tara mentioned it last week, is that we try to satiate our thirst with salty water. It doesn't work. So whether it's compulsive eating or drinking or drugging or judging or raising or spending, raging or spending, we all have our way that we get hijacked by the wanting mind. There's an ad out of Outdoor magazine where we have this guy sitting in this lotus position, or not really a lotus position, but a cross-legged position, and he's in his outdoor clothes with his cap on, and behind him are all kinds of things. Scuba gear and camping equipment and golfing equipment and stereo equipment and a guitar and a dog and a bike and a surfboard. Just lots and lots of stuff. And on top of it's a truck. And the words on the ad are, "Spence put a new twist on an old philosophy. To be one with everything, he says, you've got to have one of everything." That's why he also has the new Ford Ranger. So he can seek wisdom on a mountaintop. This gets even more. Take off in hot pursuit of enlightenment. And connect with Mother Earth. by looking no further than into the planet's coolest four-door compact pickup. He says it gives him easy access to inner peace, which makes him one happy soul. Now, the good news is that that's how mainstream sort of meditation is, that there actually sells cars. So, the familiar, if we really look closely, we see that some of our familiar habit patterns are really causing harm. This over-consuming, it causes us harm, it causes harm to others, it causes harm to the planet. If we keep consuming without regard for the effect on this earth and of the other peoples of this earth. And really, consuming doesn't give us what we want. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with buying a Ford pickup. You know, don't get me wrong about that. But this obsessive wanting and trying to and consuming doesn't really give us what we are most deeply wanting. Because what we really know is that no thing or no experience, because it's transient, it comes and it goes. Even things get old and fall apart, or we get disinterested in them. But no thing or experience can really feed our hearts. Can really satisfy our longing for connection, for love, for feeling in communion with life. It cannot help us feel our natural capacity to give back to life, to feel like we have a purpose here, no matter how much we consume. So this truth of impermanence in Nietzsche is that we can't keep out unpleasant and we can't hold on to pleasant. They're going to come and go because of specific causes and conditions. They appear and they disappear. When Ted and I were in Canada some years ago at a waterfall, we were at the edge of the waterfall, and all of a sudden this rainbow appeared, like almost as if you could reach out and touch it. And it just like it came out of nowhere. And what happened, of course, were causes and conditions arose that were perfect. The right amount of moisture, the light coming through, it fragmenting or splitting the white light into all of the colors of the light spectrum. And there in front of me was this rainbow. Came out of nowhere, came out of nothing. And then the wind blew, and it blew because this was the mist coming off of the waterfall. The wind blew, and then it was gone. Like the conditions changed and the rainbow was gone. That is the truth of a Nietzsche. We think that we're so solid. We think that there's a consistency and a solidity to things. And actually, it's causes and conditions changing so that pleasant arises or unpleasant arises. Feelings arise. Thoughts arise. Just like the rainbow. You know that all life comes and goes. There is something called the five remembrances that are deep teachings about impermanence. The first one is, I am of the nature to grow old. I am not beyond aging. I am of the nature to become ill. I have not gotten beyond illness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gotten beyond death. All that is mine, dear and delightful, will vanish or change. And the fifth remembrance is that I am the owner of my actions. I am supported by my actions, related through my actions, and live dependent in my actions. Whatever I do, whether good or evil, that I will inherit. That even though everything will come and go, that how we respond to the action that we take is really going to decide whether we're happy or unhappy, whether we're suffering or we're free from suffering. I talked with a friend today whose father is nearing the end of his life. And I know there's other people in this room. I'm sure there's other people in this room who have people close in who are ill or dying. It's just how it is. And the great gift of this practice of mindfulness and kindness is that we find a way to make friends with what's difficult, to find the presence of mind, which this friend was describing, to be there with his father, to not hold back, even though his father is not conscious right now or responding right now. But to find a way to be at peace with the inevitable loss that's going to be part of our lives and not think there's something wrong about it. To be free in the face of the reality of loss. To kind of put the Buddha's teachings in a nutshell, I like this because I like pithy little things to help me remember. It's do no harm, act for the good, purify the mind. That's the whole Dharma in three short sentences. So do no harm. You know, and we've been talking about what causes harm. Getting caught, getting hijacked into these patterns of wanting and not wanting, of judging and consuming. Just can you imagine, what if for one day we could refrain from harming ourselves? Just sort of imagine what that would be like, to stop buying into the thoughts that arise of you being some kind of a limited self, that there's something wrong or missing in you. To really challenge the core beliefs that we hold that are just based on familial upbringing and cultural conditioning. We all have them. Tara spoke about core beliefs last week and how can we, when a core belief about our unworthiness or something being wrong or missing or inadequateness, can we just ask the question, is this true? Is it really true? To stop buying into and feeding the critic that's inside. To challenge, to be a champion for our own selves, the way we would champion a child if someone was saying those words to them. Even for one day, if we could do that. Or maybe 1 hour, if we could do that. What would that be like? To do no harm to ourselves. And then, what would it be like to refrain from causing harm to others? You know, to not say those unkind words or engage in those kind of aggressive actions. Or what if we had a day where we didn't withhold our care towards each other? I mean, even when we judge each other but don't say anything, it hurts us. Do you know what it feels like to be in a sort of self-righteous judging mode? It causes harm to our own heart, to our own stress levels. So the Buddha said, do no harm. But then he said, also act for the good. This is really about the Bodhisattva path that Lama Shuridas spoke about a couple of weeks ago. That it's not enough to just not harm. We also need to help. To see what good we can do for others, to practice generosity, to practice wholehearted kindness, just to be less selfish, more concerned about the other than about ourselves. And Lama said, no one can do it all, but no one is exempt from participating in this second acting for the good. That we can actually become a kind of living embodiment of harmlessness and helpfulness. And then third, purifying the mind. That's basically through the practice of meditation. The Buddha said, if it were not possible to free the heart from entanglement in greed, hatred, and fear, I would not teach you to do so. That's the purification of the mind, to be freeing the heart and mind from the entanglement of greed and fear and hatred. So how did he do this? He taught mindfulness. Sati is the word in Pali. I like that word, sati. So this mindfulness that we've been practicing tonight, mindfulness in listening and speaking, mindfulness in coming into the body and the heart and feeling what the inner weather system is like. One of the definitions of mindfulness that I really like is that it's a mirror-like quality of the mind that sees, that knows what's arising in awareness without interfering with it. Not adding anything like an opinion, like a concept, like a judgment, and not taking anything away. It's this capacity of our mind, really, to not resist anything or to not cling. This mirror-like quality where we just can note it's like this and see, like anger is like this, then we can see how it expresses in the body. The tightness and the trembling, the heat. We can see how anger, how it is in the mind, the story that we're telling ourselves about why we're so angry. And we can begin to see who we really are taking ourselves to be when we're caught in that anger. We can see the component parts of anger just like the component parts of the rainbow. It's just causes and conditions coming together. And we can learn to not take it so personally. One of the phrases I like is, Buddha's mind is angry today. To not identify with, it's not my anger, it's the anger. It's just things coming together, feelings in the body, sensations, a story. And if we don't feed it, if we don't claim it as ours, it comes and it goes. We don't have to cause harm because we're angry. And it's the same with sadness or judging or thinking or hearing. It's like this. Pat Coffey, one of the great teachers that teaches with IMCW, calls it NPR, non-preferential receptivity. I really like that. It's like, and I can't remember, it's just like NPR. It's just to be, not to prefer anything, just allow what's here and to receive it. Well, we have to get to the video, so. So when we step out of the familiar, we see the change that's occurring. And if we can see that it's all changing, we see that suffering happens when we try to cling or we try to push away. And that our own sense of self is very much like that rainbow. That we get to see that the essential nature, just like the rainbow, there's no self there. The phenomena is selfless and empty. And this emptiness is empty of a separate, solid self. It's not emptiness like we don't exist. It's just the sense that we're not solid and we're not separate from the rest of the world. Another great contemporary teacher, Adyashanti, says it this way: all that is necessary to awaken to yourself as the radiant emptiness of spirit is to stop seeking something more or better or different and to turn your attention inward to the awake silence that you are. So what we're really talking about here is taking refuge in Buddha nature, in our true nature, to take refuge in the mirror that's reflecting. And it's a perfectly constructed mirror. It's not like one of those funhouse mirrors that distorts what it sees. It's a pristine mirror that even underneath the haze of whatever our conditioning is that seems to cloud it, is that we really are that radiance. And by practicing mindfulness, whether it's in formal practice, in sitting practice or walking practice, or in the mindfulness of everyday life, we can begin to shift out of that familiar racing after the transient pleasure and pushing away transient pain and can rest more and more in the kind of emptiness of anatta, that openness, that tenderness, that awake presence that is actually powerful enough to be with whatever difficulties come our way. A Buddha said it this way, O nobly born, remember the pure open sky of your true nature. Return to it. Trust it. It is home. And this power of mindfulness can show us that what's out there, the people and the places and the things in our life, really do not have this kind of intrinsic power to make us suffer or to make us happy. That we actually divest authority. We take back the authority from the outside for our own peace of mind, for our own well-being. We get that it's an inside job. It's not about circumstances being a certain way. The beauty also of this practice is that when we turn towards what's difficult and we really can cultivate a mind that can be open and receptive and tender, and we can cultivate these mind states of love and wisdom, that we become familiar with our true nature, that we actually begin to step into what I think of as our original familiar, being that mirror, our true nature. And we also see that others are, we see others in their true nature, that we actually see what I'm coming to call basic awesomeness. And when we're in basic awesomeness, the separate self falls away. And people love it when we step into our basic awesomeness. And this is a video. Let me set it up. It's 3.5 minutes. It is the English version of American Idol. You know American Idol, where regular old normal people come and they sing, and some of them are really horrible, and it seems so embarrassing. And then they go through all of these competitions, and then there's the one American Idol for that round. Well, this is what this is from England, and this is a man named Paul who is a cell phone salesman. And some of you may have already seen this from, because it's been on television. But just think about, and if you're over here, you may not be able to see it quite so well, but we'll play it again afterwards. But just feel the basic awesomeness and his willingness to step out of the familiar and take a risk.
The world of showbiz seems a million miles away.
It's Paul, a mobile phone salesman from South Wales.
By day, I sell mobile phones. My dream is to spend my life doing what I feel that I was born to do.
Paul, what are you here for today, Paul?
To sing opera. I've always wanted to sing as a career. Confidence has always been sort of like a difficult thing for me. I've always found it a little bit difficult to be completely confident in myself.
Okay. Ready when you are.
Oh!
like a car phone warehouse. And you did that. I wasn't expecting that.
No, neither was I.
This was a complete breath of fresh air. I thought you were absolutely fantastic.
You have an incredible voice. I think if you keep singing like that, you are going to be one of the favourites to win this whole competition.
I think that we've got a case of a little lump of coal here that is going to turn into a diamond.
Okay. Moment of truth, young man. Piers.
Absolutely yes.
Amanda?
Yes.
Paul? You are true to the next round.
Congratulations.
Unbelievable. I have so simple.
You must be over the moon.
I am. A bit shocked.
Are you?
And as Paul heads home happy, the judges think they might have found something special in Cardiff.
I like shows where somebody isn't a professional, has a talent, isn't aware of it, has a normal job, and then you see something else. I like that. And that's what that guy
is. I'll discover a little gem.
Yeah.
A frog that will turn into a prince.
I can't believe I'm not bursting into tears. I cry every time I see that. And I really wanted to share it because I feel like it shows us that if we can step out and we can take a risk, that everybody benefits. That in this practice of breaking habits and stepping out of the familiar, we become interested in each other's welfare. You know, there's this story of a whole banquet of food and people sitting, and they have these big long spoons and they're trying to feed themselves, but they can't because the spoons are so long that they can't get it into their mouth. And they're starving. They're sitting at the table starving until one person looks at the person across from them and gets that if they feed the person across from them, that the next person that he'll feed, he would feed me. And that one shift from caring more about getting something for ourselves to giving something to someone else allows everyone to feast at the table. It really is the recognition that we need each other. There's a card that actually Ted gave me many years ago when we were going through a difficult time. And it says, separately we are as fragile. We weren't going through a difficult time. We were going through a difficult time together. I don't know why I need to say that. Separately, we are as fragile as reeds and as easily broken. But together, we are as strong as reeds tied in a bundle. This is inspired by Jewish writings. This is a Hallmark card. They're getting better and better. So we learn to savor this life, because it is so fleeting and it is so fresh, precious. And we learn to serve because it's our natural inclination is to serve each other. Pema Chodron said, "How did I get so lucky to have my heart awakened to others and to their suffering?" Can you imagine? How could I be so lucky? So with this practice, we can feel deeply the truth of our interconnectedness, what Thich Nhat Hanh calls our interbeing, that we're all part of this web, not separate, not independent, but interdependent on this whole web of life. We're all here tonight. We're all alive tonight because of the efforts of so many other people. This is really taking refuge in Sangha, the Sangha of this earth. So let's just sit for a moment as a way of ending. And I'll share with you the poem that inspired me to take this theme of leaving the familiar. So again, just connecting, two-thirds in the body, one-third listening. Just noticing how it is right now. Aware of sensations, of sound, whatever the inner weather system is right now, what it's like to be inside your own skin. The great poet and mystic Hafiz writes, "Leave the familiar for a while. Let your senses and bodies stretch out like a welcomed season onto the meadows and shores and hills. Open up to the roof. Make a new watermark on your excitement and your love. Like a blooming night flower, bestow your vital fragrance of happiness and giving upon our intimate assembly here. Change rooms in your mind for a day, and know that all the hemispheres in existence lie beside an equator in your heart. It's all right here. Greet yourself in your thousand other forms as you mount the hidden tide and travel back home to your basic awesomeness. All the hemispheres in heaven are sitting around a fire, chatting, while stitching themselves together into the great circle inside of you." Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.